This is Age of Treason Radio.
First thing I remember was asking Papa why. For there were many things I didn't know.
On the White Network.
By the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's gone. You better learn it fast, you better learn it young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
The time and tears went by.
Good evening. The title of tonight's installment is Who's White? I've mentioned this several times before, and it's something, it's a question really that everyone knows the answer to, or at least they think they know. And yet many people, especially white people, pretend at least some of the time that they don't know who's white. They act as if they're stumped by this question. Or worse, they pretend that they know and they think it means nothing. It isn't important. On the part of white people, at least, when it's white people doing this, it's simple denial. What white means is important and it is significant. The significance is both existential, in the sense that it has to do with dealing with reality, dealing with existence, the world around us as it is. And it's significant because it's transcendental. It has to do with concerns beyond common, ordinary, individual experience outside yourself, before and beyond your own life. And it can be a source of pride and provide a context, a meaning to your life, a sense of perspective, understanding, and well-being, rather than this albatross around your neck, this guilt and the shame that is accompanied by a vague sense of confusion and dread that I think most white people suffer from. When they think about race, these are the negative feelings they get. And it's no wonder, because as I've spent most of my time in these podcasts focusing on, has been an exploration of these negative adversarial attitudes towards whites and whiteness, the guilt tripping, the litany of white sins, identity politics, and how that's about everyone but whites having an identity. And for whites, this is the view of whiteness that they know best. This is what's taught in schools. This is what's presented in the mainstream media. So it's no wonder that whites feel bad whenever they think about white identity and race. The takeaway, I would say, from this review of this overview of negative white identity and identity as a whole is that biological group identity operates over a range, over a continuum. That's true of other groups besides whites. And that what's conspicuous about whites, well, and that these group identities form and dissolve and shift over various scales of the size of the group and over periods of time. But what's significant from a white point of view is this conspicuous hole in the identity spectrum. How any group identity above the family and below humanity as a whole is taboo, forbidden to whites, and for whites alone, really. That whole racial range from tribe and ethnic, nation, and race. And that's what we're not supposed to think about. Especially when it comes to taking tangible action based on that understanding, that knowledge, for instance, in discriminating your own group from others, or excluding others from your group identity, telling them, hey, you're not white. Sorry. We're not even sorry, not even apologizing for it. There's no need to apologize for it. You're just not white. We don't like to think like that in general. Whites don't. And it's no mystery why, because we're told we're bad people if we do that. So one answer to the question, who's white, is pretty easy. It falls out of this negative identity of whites, and it's whites are the people who aren't supposed to identify as a group because we're responsible for oppressing every other group. Or alternatively, whites are the people who are supposed to think who aren't supposed to think about who we are, except to take blame for everybody else's problems. Or another way of saying it, whites are the people who are supposed to open our societies to everyone else, because we don't want to be stupid, crazy, evil racists. Whites are the people who, when we start talking about us and our interests, people feel perfectly comfortable saying, well, gee, who's white anyway? Whereas, in contrast, if you substitute any other group identity in there, people would feel uncomfortable. It would be considered rude or offensive even to say the same thing to non-whites. Say, well, gee, who's a people of color anyway? And in fact, you can say, you could make the same claims that are made about whites and who's white, about blacks or about Asians or about Latinos or Hispanics. So they can't even decide whether they're Latino or Hispanic, or Jews for that matter. And people of color is just the most obvious, glaring contradiction or proof that there's nothing wrong with whiteness as an identity, just without knowing anything else but those other identities. So another nutshell way to sum up the negative view of whiteness is whites are the people who aren't non-white. I said that in one of the previous installments. I pointed that out. I didn't just make that one up. People actually make that claim that that's whites are just a mythical people that are just aren't non-white. And there's a kind of flip side to this. If you want to take a pro-white reactionary view based on this negative identity and say that whites are the people who anti-whites hate. But I'm not really satisfied with that. And I'm tired. I've said it before. I'm tired of talking about the negative aspects of whiteness. I've covered them thoroughly, I think, and I will continue to talk about them, but I'd like to move on and talk more about a positive view. Unfortunately, these things have to be discussed because many whites have internalized this negative view of whiteness. And I'm speaking especially of ordinary white folk, the people who are absorbed with their daily goings on and don't really have time to think about race or identity, especially when it's pathologized and demonized. But even many racialists, people who identify themselves as white nationalists, who have grappled with race and have a deeper understanding of it, most of them were at one point ordinary folk too. And it was only after they experienced some kind of an awakening that they became racially aware and took it upon themselves to understand better whiteness and race in general. Whites as a group are generally, I think it's safe to say, fearful of thinking and certainly fearful of speaking about race, afraid to express a white identity of any sort, or even simple sympathy for whites. Ann Coulter is going around promoting a book, her most recent book lately, and she's talking about how white liberals have been bad for the blacks. This is her argument. She's saying white guilt has been bad. Why is it bad? Because it's been bad for blacks. And I mention her because she is a implicitly white icon. You know, a lot of white people look up to her, especially conservative white people, and think the world of her, think she's very intelligent, very witty. But she won't defend white people as white people. She won't say that white guilt is bad because it's bad for white people. She says white guilt is bad because it's been bad for black people. and that white conservatives are better for black people than white liberals have been. It's an outrageous argument from a person, and it's a betrayal, in a sense, of a person whose fans are nearly 100% white, and that's how she treats them. Even deracinated white people, though, can, you know, you have to admit that they can see a difference between black and white, and they act on that difference. They just that difference is too stark to ignore. It's not safe to ignore. It's too, the consequences are too costly. And the problem really comes in when whites try to explain or justify what they're thinking or why they're doing what they're doing. They go about their lives searching out good schools and nice neighborhoods and mindlessly creating tea parties and whitetopias, thinking that they're blind to race. And little do they realize just how, quote unquote, racist this behavior is, because it's white. White people looking for a better life for ourselves and our families is racism. And if white people don't understand that yet, they eventually will. I think it's safe to say that most whites don't think more subtly than black and white, that coarse differences in race when they think about race. It's even some racialists don't think about the fine distinctions. And they don't think about these distinctions that I've made between ethnic and nation and race. What they know about race is that it's bad, bad, bad to think too deeply about these kinds of things. They see how Mitt Romney is attacked for, it wasn't even him, it was a spokesman of his saying something about the special relationship of Anglo-Saxon United States with Anglo-Saxon England. And, of course, Pat Buchanan is another name that's often thrown around as a horrible racist, and David Duke, and it all leads back to Adolf Hitler, the biggest white boogeyman of all. And that's what you get if you think too deeply about race. And pathologizing whites, demonizing whites who do think and talk about such things by calling them ignorant has an especially perverse effect. It actually produces this willful ignorance about race and identity from the people who don't want to be called ignorant. They willfully make themselves ignorant. They refuse to think. And I think that that's the intent. I think the result is too clear and too predictable to not have been the intent. But beside that, what makes whites feel stupid about questions like, well, who's white anyway, is not knowing or not thinking that they know the answer to coy questions like that. The insinuation of a question like that is that whiteness is an invalid identity, that nobody knows who's white, or that it doesn't matter. And as we know, of course people know, as generally speaking, who's white, and it does matter. All of identity politics revolves around whiteness. It's all about whites being the oppressors of all the non-whites. It's a white, non-white divide. So, of course, white exists, and people of color wouldn't exist if there wasn't a white to be in contrast to. The purpose of a question like, oh, well, who's white, is to sow doubt in people's minds, to discourage thought and investigation, not to encourage it. Whiteness is implicitly seen as an exclusive, as superior, and because there's no fixed consensus, and it has shifted over time, the boundaries of whiteness, there's this doubt that's placed in people's minds that, well, you know, maybe you're not white enough. Maybe you, your family, or your friends might be excluded from that exclusive superior club. So it's better to just squash the whole idea, forget about it. And in fact, the question is seen and played like a trump card. And that's what that smart-ass Jew that I quoted commenting on the white student union at Towson University seemed to think when he wrote, question, I am white, really, really white, as in pretty much only from Western Europe. So naturally, I'd be allowed to join, right? However, I'm also Jewish. He knows right there that there's a problem that as a Jew, his identity comes before any whiteness that he tries to claim. And he signs his little missive sincerely, when it's really insincere. Sincerely, somebody who already knows the answer. Yeah, he already knows the answer is right. And he was just trying to sow doubt, just trying to make it sound like there's a problem with whiteness, because whites would exclude Jews, or should exclude Jews. So who is white? And let's just get to the bottom line here. The short answer is that white means European. It means people of European heritage. And that includes the European diaspora, the Europeans who have colonized other continents in the decades and centuries since the white man first started heading out of Europe and established population centers in other parts of the world. Well, this definition of white as European just begs the question, then, who's a European? What are the boundaries of Europe? And as I said, it's the geographic bounds have already been jumped by whites moving to other places in the world. And it's really more of a genetic boundary today. The geographic bounds have shifted dramatically, and there's all sorts of non-Europeans now flooding into Europe. The people within Europe, even before that, though, and especially on the boundaries of Europe, had significant genetic and cultural distinctions between them. And some were so distinct, so and spread so wide across Europe, that they aren't or shouldn't be considered European, or for that matter, white. And I'm thinking in particular of the Gypsies, also known as the Roma, and the Jews. And when I say spread so wide, I mean these people populate all the countries of Europe and call themselves either Gypsies, Roma, or the Jews, and identify themselves as really a nation within a nation. And another question that this begs, this idea of, you know, who's white? It's people of European heritage. Well, how much European heritage do you have to be white? And historically, Europeans, whites have had, at least in America, a one-drop rule, meaning any non-European heritage means you're not white. And I'll discuss this further in an installment specifically dedicated to miscegenation and race mixing and the consequences of that, because it's a meaty, meaty subject. And I have some personal interest in it. So, white is European. What do you know about Europe? Well, when I think back to what I learned in school about European history and what's taught in school, I remember mostly a recitation of names and dates and leaders and battles. Caesar, Charlemagne, Napoleon, Hitler. Through school and the media, you learn about the cultural differences, even if you don't live in Europe, between the different countries, the disparate languages, the different clothing and food, the various sects of Christianity. But all of this teaching mostly leaves out race. And I'm old enough now, it goes back into the 60s, that this race has been, at least white history and from a white point of view, has been downplayed. And certainly the subtle intra-European racial differences and distinctions are left out. And to the extent they do discuss it, they pathologize it and give a very one-dimensional view that it's nationalism especially is painted as an arbitrary ideological divide and conquer type of thing. And it's the root cause of senseless wars. And it's the senseless wars that they're making you memorize the names and dates of. So what whites really need to help them understand white identity, I think, is authentic white history with race included, a narrative and an explanation that incorporates a racial understanding of what happened, who was doing what to who, and for what reason. Also that it is a white narrative, meaning it's a positive, sympathetic point of view, not told from our adversary's point of view, or painting us as the oppressors of everyone else, as mean, stupid, crazy, evil people. It should be about who we are, what we've done, where we've been, and where we could go yet. A vision for the future, a positive vision. And there are several books that I can recommend that I thought about that I've either read or have know of. And I'll talk about those in a future installment too, as soon as the next one. But I want to say a few words here about the problem of nomenclature and setting aside the issue for the moment of the white people who have no use for the word white, who can't relate to white because they consider it too broad. You know, it's too cosmopolitan for them. You know, I'm not white, I'm Irish or I'm Anglo-Saxon. That also is a subject that I'll deal with in another installment in the near future. But I'm thinking here of the nomenclature, the name of the racial grouping that I'm talking about. And I use white. I always have used white. I think it's a simple word. It's well known. It's in common use. But there are other words, and this is something that's often debated amongst white racialists, white advocates, is, you know, we shouldn't call ourselves white. We should call ourselves European or Caucasian or Occidentals or whatever. In America, American used to be what American whites would call ourselves. And today you have to say white American because American has become too much of other people. Anybody who's born within the borders of America now is an American. So that name is losing its value. Aryan is another word that comes up in these contexts, and maybe we should call ourselves Aryans. And if you're like me, you learn nothing but negative things about the word Aryan in school and on television. It's associated with horrible, horrible racism and the Nazis and the National Socialists, Hitler, and so forth. But I want to know. I want to know about this stuff, and I want to face it square on. I want to know, what does this word mean? And what's the history behind it? And I found an excellent summary of it that corresponds to and complements a lot of the information that I've read before and in other books about the subject of a racial history of Europeans. And so I'm going to read it. And I think I've read long sections of adversarial text before, so I'm going to spend the rest of this installment and probably a good part of the next one reading this item, because I think it does such a good job of explaining not only Aryan, and that's not really the purpose here. I'm not this doesn't make the argument, and I'm not trying to use it as an argument that we should call ourselves Aryans. Instead, it's more of an explanation of where that word comes from and what it means, and it helps us to understand what role it plays in European history and who Europeans are. So the title of it is Racial Nationalism and the Aryans. And the subtitle is Who Were the Aryans? It's signed Ehrman, and I assume this is Ehrman Vinson, who is the proprietor of this website that I found this on. He wrote a book that perhaps I'll review sometime called Some Thoughts on Hitler and Other Essays. Very good writer. Very to the point. So with no further ado, let me get on with this. It begins. The Aryans were semi-nomadic Nordic whites, perhaps located originally on the steppes of southern Russia and Central Asia, who spoke the parent language of the various Indo-European languages. Latin, Greek, Hittite, Sanskrit, French, German, Latvian, English, Spanish, Russian, etc. are all Indo-European languages. Indo-European, or more properly, Proto-Indo-European, which he abbreviates PIE, I think that's the common abbreviation for it, is the lost ancestral language from which those languages ultimately derive. The proto indicates that the grammar and vocabulary of this long-extinct language, probably spoken up until 3000 BC, are a hypothetical reconstruction by modern philologists. Philology, by the way, is the study of literary texts and written records. Just as Romance languages like Italian and Spanish derive from Latin, so Latin derives from Proto-Indo-European. Indo-European philology traditionally uses, quote, Aryan, both to denote a people understood racially or ethnically, and the language group itself, Aryan speech, irrespective of the race or ethnicity of the people speaking its various branches. In the wake of National Socialist Germany's defeat, the term fell out of general scholarly use in both senses, and Indo-European, quote-unquote Indo-European, became the preferred designation of the language group. Quote-unquote Indo-Europeans of both the people who occupied the original Aryan homeland and their descendants, who gradually spread out across Europe, much of the Indian subcontinent, and parts of the Near East. Racial nationalists are not, of course, obliged to adopt the timid PC lexicon of contemporary scholarship, but we should be aware of imprecision of Aryan as a racial or ethnic classification. Arya, meaning noble, appears in various Indo-European languages. Its plural form, Aryas, nobles, was probably the name the Aryans used to describe themselves prior to their dispersal, and it may survive in Ireland, and certainly survives in Iran. I'm not sure of the pronunciation of this pair of words, Aryanam Vieho, which translates as realm of the Aryans. The discovery of thousands of such cognate words. Oh, by the way, you know, it would be nice to be taught in a school these things where you could get the accepted pronunciation of such things instead of struggling with them, as I am. Along with similar grammatical structures, let me read this again here. The discovery of thousands of such cognate words in widely separated languages, along with similar grammatical structures, led philologists to conclude early in the 19th century that most European languages had evolved from a common proto-language spoken millennia ago by a distinct people who gradually left their original homeland in a series of migrations, carrying their language with them. What he's describing here is how the traces of the languages, that they've traced the roots back almost in the same way that genetics can be traced back and tied in to the geographical location so that you can follow the footsteps, as it were, to piece together the migrations of people over time. And there are those two aspects of it, the culture, the language aspect, and the genetics. And I'll talk about the genetics more in another installment in the future. I think I'm about out of time here, but I hope you're enjoying this. There's quite a bit more to go. It'll probably take quite a bit of the next installment to finish this. But I think it's a very, very good summation of what it means to be a European. Where did the Europeans come from? And why this word Aryan that you've probably heard before and heard bad things about, why, you might be thinking. So I hope that this will explain it. Don't be afraid. We're going to learn about it, and we're going to learn about it together.